The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins is brought to you by Audible. Audible has an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more. Get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial at www.audible.com/undisclosed. Also, the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. Enjoy the program.
Dee Watkins here with Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Today I'll be joined by my co-host, Justine Barron. Justine's a nonprofit and political consultant and screenwriter. We also have award-winning person, Stephen Janis, the author of Why Do We Kill? The Pathology of Murder in Baltimore. And Jill Carter, the director of the Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement, is a former state delegate for Baltimore's 41st District, where she served for 14 years. She was appointed by Mayor Catherine Pugh to lead the OCRWE at this critical juncture in the city's history as the mayor ushers in a new approach to policing and police and community relations sparked by a newly signed consent decree between the United States Department of Justice, the Baltimore City Police Department, and the Baltimore City Government. How you guys doing today?
We're doing well, thanks. Thanks for having us.
Good.
So much to talk about today. I really, really, really wanted to talk to Jill about what she's doing and the changes that are going to happen with the civilian review board. But I want to start with the trial, Justine. If you can kick us off and just touch on some of the things that were highlighted in the episode and some of the major things that you took away. Starting with Mosby's approach and then maybe leading to Judge Barry Williams.
Okay. Stephen can jump in on this. I think that what might be surprising to some of our listeners who aren't in Baltimore and didn't follow the trials very closely is that the case put on by the state's attorney's office really may never have had a chance, and that Judge Williams, by all accounts, was reasonably fair. So this may not have been one of those cases of the odds are so stacked against civilians hurt by police that even a good case can't be won in court. From our point of view, at least, there wasn't necessarily a good case.
Let me frame it like this. When officers started walking away, everyone in the city who weren't following the case as closely as maybe some of us were upset with the judge. They felt like he had every reason to convict them, every reason for those charges to stick, and they just didn't. And they felt like it was another example of a person who works with the system, within the system, allowing it to function the way it was. But some of us felt like that wasn't the case.
Right. That hasn't been our takeaway. That hasn't been the takeaway of anyone we talked to, even incredibly progressive people fighting for police reform. Nobody we've talked to has thought that this case brought forward by the state's attorney's office was winnable on these charges. They did not have any proof, in our opinion. So, but I'm curious what Stephen thinks about, you know, this.
Well, if you don't mind, I can give a little context, because there are a couple things that the state's attorney was facing, which is, you know, the almost near impossibility of convicting a police officer. I remember a case back in 2008 when I was a reporter, a young man named Edward Lamont Hunt was shot by police officer Tommy Sanders in the back. And there were like 20 witnesses who watched this shooting unfold. And the state's attorney charged Tommy Sanders very unusually with manslaughter, and he was acquitted, even though there were 7 or 8 eyewitnesses who literally saw him shoot in the back. So the state's attorney was facing a tremendous hurdle. But on top of that, I mean, the case really hinged upon the fact that the police officers disobeyed a general order, which said that they should have seatbelted him in. And, you know, I don't think Judge Williams had made up in his mind, from what I could tell, that that didn't rise to the level of being criminal negligence. So it made it very difficult for them, because that was what the primary thing hinged upon, you know, what they did to Freddie Gray. But, you know, if you watch the way the trial unfolded, you know, after the important decision that Judge Williams made that changed the course of this trial was the decision not to make the jury go back and deliberate an extra day. Judge Warner Heard was hearing a case of a police officer who shot a man who came out of a store, and the jury came back hung after one day, and she made them go back, and 2 days later they delivered a guilty verdict. In this case, that was William Porter's trial, where he, where the jury was close to convicting him of misconduct was Judge Williams immediately declared it a mistrial, right? So what does that tell you?
It was just one juror, right?
It was just one juror. It was one juror away. One more day probably would have netted a conviction. Now imagine the chain of events if indeed you have a conviction in that trial. And remember, it is highly unusual for a prosecution to be forced to try six cases separately. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen to any defendant that walks into Baltimore City Circuit Court. Not a single freaking one. So if you think about it.
Well, you
got
to be a cop or a really rich person.
You got to be a cop.
To get a separate trial.
You
got to
be a cop. You could, well, I guess you could be rich and white.
Like,
maybe, yes.
Well, Puff Daddy got tried, in the, if that's in New York.
Yeah,
but
yeah that's
he's
true.
He's very rich.
That's
like,
true.
He's rich,
that's
he's rich like a white person.
Well, you know, not many rich people end up in Baltimore City Circuit right. Court, okay? Yeah. From anyone who sat in there, it's not a parade right. of rich people. So, nevertheless, you know, that is highly unusual to trial those cases. It puts the prosecution at a supreme disadvantage because the defense can sit there and just watch and see all the evidence and then get ready for each subsequent trial. So, you know, I think that...
So
I
you said, you, but if you wouldn't call it criminal negligence, what would mm-hmm. you call it?
Well, I mean, I think it would... Well, I can't have an
well,
opinion.
Well, not you,
well,
I'm just...
Here was critical because they had an expert witness who came in and said, well, ignoring general orders is de rigueur, is the culture of the police department. So how can you blame these officers for ignoring general orders when it happens all the time? So that's, I think that put a big...
I hope somebody would say that to me if I ever went to court. Oh, well, he's just, you know, he ignores the law every day. So, you know, of course he's not going to follow it on a Tuesday.
Just like a slight nuance to a couple of things, just from my point of view. Like, you know, one of the issues with the general order was that it was literally just issued. There was no paper trail, which they have now. Now police have to sign something electronically to show that they received the general order. I have heard officers tell me that they don't think they ever got that general order before, you know, April 12th, and that it was only on April 12th after Freddie Gray was heard that they were suddenly hearing everybody read this general order. So it was really days before, and it wasn't even that clear. That is part of the problem. Now, if there had been ongoing consistent training and this order had been around long enough that police officers need to know to seatbelt, that just wasn't the case. In terms of Williams and the short turnaround, you know, I actually thought that myself, and then I talked to a number of attorneys who told me that they didn't think that it was such a short turnaround, and that if a judge is to tell a jury, if you put yourself in the hot seat, now you're being accused of a crime, and the jury comes back hung, and the judge says, go back and keep working on it, that might be a compromise system for a judge to say, I'm not satisfied with your outcome. So that's just another way to look at those two issues.
I just think that normally, though, when you talk about the charges, normally, I believe the initial officers would have been charged with first-degree assault before Freddie Gray was even placed in the van, and that would have been additional charges. And I also think that the average defendant is going to be charged with conspiracy, whether they think they can make it stick or not. And once that conspiracy charge is in there, that would have changed the outcome most likely in terms of the ability to try them separately. So I do think that the nature of the charges probably impacted the outcome.
Yeah, I agree.
And they were much different than the average defendant.
Jill is a lawyer and an award-winning writer, too. So,
I mean, there was that... I think I'm kind of vaguely recalling the prosecution brought up the fact that they had done that whole survey of people, seatbelting people in the vans, and they had cited some of the Lieutenant Rice and for not seatbelting. I think there was some awareness of this. I don't think it was completely. And they had an electronic email that was coarse. So the email was open, correct? Or was it not?
They get so many emails a day and they don't have the capacity to read most of them. Mm-hmm. And all of that, I think, has been verified by my own research that mm-hmm. there's no standards by which they're supposed to check their emails. And under Commissioner Batts, there was no standard to verify that they had read or received any order, especially orders that have hundreds of pages of attachments, you know, right. emails that right. have that many attachments. Now, if they had been able to find a crime that's not just not following orders related to not taking care of somebody medically, or as Jill said, you know, injuring somebody at stop one, not getting the medical care when they're crying out for help, you know, they didn't pursue those routes.
What other profession can you say that I don't have time to open right. emails though? Like, I'm a doctor and there's like a new way for me to slice your brain in half, but like, you know, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to perform this procedure, but, you know, I didn't read the emails telling me what type of tools to use. Like, it's crazy because, you know, the profession wants to be respected and it wants to be held at this high regard, but you don't want to do simple stuff like read your emails.
Well, you're talking about a department that has regularly, I mean, look at the Justice Department report on unconstitutional practices throughout the department. I think if they're breaking the Constitution, maybe general orders are much easier to ignore. And I mean, you know, we have to remember the reality that the type of policing they were doing was the type of policing that had been accepted in Baltimore as you know, sort of the way things should be done. There was nothing unusual about what they were doing from the perspective of the political establishment here that sort of has embraced that kind of policing. I mean, you have to think about it. Why were they up at, like, what, 9 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday chasing people down the street? I mean, that says something about what Baltimore policing is like.
Well, yeah, but an order is an order, and none of us could, or no one can rightfully just disobey a judge's order by saying, hey, judge, I didn't read the paperwork when you gave it to me to go to parole and probation. You were ordered to do so. An order is an order. And so I do think that there was a violation. I think the issue is, of course, did the violation amount to the depraved heart standard, which is probably the difficult thing criminally, but more reasonable administratively.
Hey guys, it's Amelia. I've always been a passionate reader, but a few years ago, I picked up a new hobby that got in the way of my old one: tapestry weaving. Yeah, it's kind of weird, but I'm obsessed, and I spend a lot of my free time in front of the loom, surrounded by yarn. Unfortunately, it's pretty much impossible to read and weave at the same time. Trust me, I've tried. But thanks to Audible.com, I don't have to choose between books and fiber arts, because for the last 3 years, I've been letting Audible.com read to me while I weave. Have I mentioned my other passion is multitasking? Audible has an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. Right now, I've got two nonfiction books by women at the top of my download list. There's Roxane Gay's new memoir, Hunger, and Lizzie Goodman's Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. Click and click. And I've got some great news. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/undisclosed. That's audible.com/undisclosed and get started today.
So let's just go back to this whole Barry Williams situation. Justin, you feel like Williams didn't really have a shot. There was really nothing that he could do, or you felt like there just wasn't enough evidence for him to give the people what they wanted.
I'm not a lawyer. I've talked to lawyers. You do have a lawyer on the panel. I will say that he did reject many motions to dismiss. And in that regard, I felt like he, based on my research and talking to attorneys and listening to all of the trial audio and all of the bench conferences, he seemed fair to me, to the state, and if anything, at a certain point, maybe even helping them. I mean, there were motions to dismiss based on failure to charge for a crime that, you know, there was no apparent proof of a rough ride. So there may have been something to that, and another judge might have dismissed before it ever went to court. I'm not sure, though. We should talk to the attorney for sure about all of that.
I wasn't there, of course, so I always hesitate to really opine about what happened when I wasn't an attorney in the case and I wasn't involved. However, you know, at a certain point, I know that state's attorneys all the time, assistants always amend charges. You know, there was a point when the state's attorney's office most likely realized that there were problems with the charges as they stood. And I think there was probably a chance at some point to amend those charges or try to get those amended. So,
well, I'm sad in a lot of cases, and I've very rarely seen a judge dismiss charges. I mean, those motions are fairly routine to file a motion to dismiss, and I rarely see a judge when it's, you know, in that part of the process to do so. I mean,
it's very
that
unusual.
That's what they do. They file, it's pretty much a routine thing to file a motion to dismiss. It's nothing exceptional, and I don't think it really speaks to whether or not Barry Williams is being fair that he didn't. If he had done that, it would have been astounding. I've never seen a judge do that in a circuit court, take a motion to dismiss in a case already that far along. So that's not really that unusual. So
do you think, was it a shot at convicting any of these officers? Do you think that they had like a fair shot?
Well, I mean, you had a medical examiner who ruled it a homicide, right? And you didn't have any mystery as to who was involved. And, you know, I think only in Baltimore it becomes an improbability, maybe, or in, you know, but we've seen this around the country that it's very difficult to convict police officers. Like we said before, like, for example, separating all the defendants, that gives them a huge advantage. You know, there were a lot of things that happened in the trial that the media really didn't pay attention to that were kind of interesting. For example, you know, between stops one and stop two, the prosecution showed a photograph of the three officers sort of meeting in the middle of Gilmore Homes. And it was just, and then, you know, one stop later, they go and they hogtie Freddie Gray and put him in the back of the van. And, you know, the question is what happened there. And then, of course, the text messages that we've never seen because they served a warrant. They had a warrant that wasn't served. I mean, you know, I don't know much about, I'm not a lawyer again, but how can you have a warrant? I still haven't had
any. You guys aren't lawyers, but you guys are pretty smart. Like,
but I've never heard of that where you know, a prosecutor issues a subpoena for cell phone records and the sergeant refuses to serve it. So how can you even say what Judge Williams did was correct or not if the evidence wasn't fully, you know, available to the prosecution?
Well, okay, so to both of those points, you know, like what's happening between stops and one and two, you know, anyone who's been listening knows that we're very concerned about what happened, especially at stop two when he was thrown into the back of the van. Our own medical expert said that that was the most likely place that he would have had that kind of injury. There was witnesses who said that he was thrown hard into the back of the van. That's a shallow diving accident, which is what the autopsy ruling was that it was an injury like a shallow diving accident. You know, he was thrown by force into the back of the van. But if the state's attorney's office and BPD are not willing to take the time to look at that evidence and not include that story whatsoever in the trials, then in that regard, I don't know that, I mean, I agree there's a lot of the issue of conspiracy, you know, there seems to be plenty of evidence that the state's attorneys had that there was, you know, collaboration to cover up. And that wasn't the case that they brought forward, unfortunately. They didn't bring forward anything to do with human force besides sort of a longish Terry stop that is, there's so much precedent that that kind of argument almost never wins. So
if I'm a police officer, I should feel extremely confident right now. I should be walking around with my chest out. I should be thinking that I'm above the law. I don't have to subscribe to the same rules that citizens have to subscribe to. There could be warrants, you know, issued that could lead to my arrest and conviction, but they won't even get served because I, you know, I went through some training and, you know, I got a badge and a little buzz cut, and, you know, and I'm like out here. Should I feel like that?
So, no, I'll tell you why. I think that the officers in Baltimore are so not used to being held accountable for any kind of misconduct or activity or illegal or unconstitutional activity that the very charging of these officers changed the way that they felt about it, and it emboldened them to a certain extent at feeling very well within their rights to not perform policing activities. I also think that the fact that the officers are still, five of the six are facing disciplinary actions, is a message to these officers. And so what the effect has been, officers failing to take action many times because of the belief that they could be held accountable administratively. And they don't even want to be charged. Right. Like, they don't even want that to happen. And they find it, and the FOP in particular, finds it totally offensive that they were ever even charged for this.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, the officers suing Mosby is like a victory lap. Like, I feel like they're taking a victory lap. This is why I talked about them keeping their, poking their chest out.
Well, one thing I can say just from experience, that when someone is facing charges, what they really want to do is upset the prosecutor by having, like, you know, I'm interviewing a guy who's facing charges. Rarely does a defense attorney go out and say the prosecutor is a jerk or an idiot or whatever. And it's been very different with police, the way they handle. I mean, this whole thing with the FOP calling, you know, Mosby all sorts of names, and
they make memes and jokes,
yeah, all
and
sorts of stuff. And
FOP is some assholes.
You never you never see that because people, you know, don't want to make the prosecutor, you know, angry. But with the police, it's been the exact opposite. It's like they've taken sort of pleasure in poking at Marilyn Mosby, and that case is kind of pretty unusual, you know, for malicious prosecution. I've never seen that before either, but I'm sure it's happened. But their attitude towards the prosecutor is extremely unusual, and I think just shows how powerful they are. I mean, look, what you said is true. I think the most powerful organization in this, the police department, you know, what it absorbs $500 million every year, the largest percentage of our budget. Politically speaking, the FOP has more power than any organization in the city. They run the city.
So, and the state.
And the state. Yeah,
that's it's not
true.
Just with Mosby how they acted. You know, when I was in the General Assembly, I used to always argue to the, and get angry with the leadership because I was like, hello, we still make the laws that govern the police. The police don't determine their own laws. But there was a lot of reluctance on the part of the legislative leadership to even make laws to govern the police.
Yeah. So, I mean, they really run the place. They run this town. So, of course, they're going to do whatever they feel like doing. You know,
with the Blue Lives Matter hashtag. So stupid. Like, I don't think I never heard a person say that a police officer's life doesn't matter. And it's not even a life. It's just a job. Like, is it more than a job?
Well, you know, you made a good point that there is this mythologizing of policing, especially in towns like Baltimore, that turn to it as the only solution as a way to justify, especially when it doesn't work. And you made this point last time about this. And that becomes sort of a rhetorical cloud that hangs over a city, you know, that you can't question policing. I mean, Jill is a perfect example. She was, as I would point out, that she was the only person that opposed zero tolerance, which is our horrible police policy to arrest 100,000 people.
I was actually just about to segue into that. But thank you.
But what happened, you know, was that she became politically isolated and people attacked her and really, you know, a lot of media ignored her, and it was really terrible. But it showed you the power behind this use of force. You know, it's kind of part of ingrained into our psyche in the city.
Yeah, Steve is making reference to Joe P. Carter, who was the only elected official that openly opposed O'Malley's illegal arrest policies. My words would be racist, but I would call it.
No, there was, yeah, it's proven 90% of the people who arrested were African Americans. So
no, I had to grow up. I had to grow up during that time. Like, I think I went to jail for like something really crazy as a child, like riding my bike on the sidewalk, something really crazy. Like, and then I grew up to go to college, but but like it's very, very simple. And then a lot of these cases were thrown out, but it's still just the idea of you being you being detained, of you just being, you know, having a stink of the jail on you, of you just being a child and you going down Central Booking and, you know, like some drug addict is like fighting his like addiction, so they throw him in a bullpen with you and he just like throws up next to you and then take a nap on it. Like, yeah, this is like this is like real. The craziest thing I remember from ever being down there was just so this is how you normalize arresting black people for being black. There was people covering Central Booking, come right into their cell, get right on the ground and go right to sleep like nothing happened. Like, it was like, easy, you know, so you normalize it and you right next to you right next to, you know, feces, I guess is a political correct term. Yeah. And you right next to, like, you know, like throw up. Like, you just, and then you just taking a nap in the middle of it. You know, and I would like to think that if O'Malley got a chance to, you know, to sleep or lay or dwell on that bullpen for at least one night, then he probably wouldn't beat his chest about, because he still promotes.
You got to feel that the people that you're doing that to are human, and I don't know that he felt that way. So having him have that experience still wouldn't change the way he felt about us.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that was what was driving the anger of the police department in the Freddie Gray thing, because they felt like what wasn't. You know, if you think about the outrage that they had about this young man died in their custody, and anybody who sat in the trial, he died, he was tortured to death, basically. I mean, you know, he had this injury to his spine, and it took like 45 minutes or an hour for him to lose all his fat, his ability to breathe and whatever. So he's basically tortured to death in the back of that van. But the outrage about the fact of charging them shows, a sort of demonstrates, or at least symbolic of the way the police department feels about the African American community, the way it's been treated in the past, you know, because they're no one is saying, well, you know what, we're really sorry someone died in our custody. They're saying, how on earth could you charge us for letting someone die in our custody?
Right.
Some of them are. They're just not the dominant voices, and they don't feel like they can speak up. I mean, I talked to some of them. They really, really cannot go on the record for this case, even if they're long retired, because they might have a cousin in the force. Or someone has a sister in the force, and like literally somebody very long retired.
I mean, but if you don't speak up, like, you know, it doesn't count then. Like,
I mean, you're right.
Like, it doesn't mean anything. Like, you don't get no pat on the back for that. Like,
that is absolutely true that people will tell you off the record, and people will sometimes call. We're on a radio station, and they'll call, but they will identify themselves, and there are people. So you're absolutely correct.
I think
about
that's
that.
Really important that
but
the FOP doesn't.
You're right.
Police.
If you don't speak up and say it publicly, it doesn't really mean anything to the dialogue that we have to listen to.
It doesn't mean a thing. So it's like you might as well be quiet, because we don't even know if you're a real person anyway.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean that is part of the problem in this town. But I think
you can't sit back. You can't sit back and say it's okay. Like, no, like, because I'm sure if that was your brother or your nephew, then you would have everything in the world to say. But you subscribe to the same dehumanization of black people as these police officers if you don't say anything because you, well, you know, I can't speak up because, you know, I'm what FOP has the best crab feast. You know what I'm saying? Like, come on. Like,
they might not want to end up like Joe Crystal, like out of work and then having to relocate his entire family for a job he really doesn't want. And when all he ever wanted to do was be a good, decent Baltimore police, you know, officer. So there are other reasons. I mean,
it's like walking. It's like walking to my world too, though. Like I got to deal with these people. I got it when I'm home. When I'm in town. When I'm in Baltimore, I'm in Baltimore. Like I'm not. I'm everywhere. So I'm in East Baltimore. I'm at the restaurants downtown. I'm at Harbor East. I'm out. I'm everywhere. But so I got to deal with them. I can't, like, you know, so what? You got to deal with the same thing a black person going through. So what? Like,
But, you know, if we make excuses for people not wanting to speak out, let's look at the Baltimore 7, the 7 officers arrested. And you knew Officer Detective Herschel. You know, they went around the city.
Too well. I know him too well.
They went around the city not only stealing overtime. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, but stealing money from innocent people.
Is that like a form I can fill out to get money that I lost first?
So when you have a department that's committing crimes against people, and destroying people's lives, is it okay to say you don't have to say anything about it because you don't want to get a better job, because you can't get a better job? Is that really okay?
We have to look at some of the leadership. I know much more about Anthony Betts than who came before, but he was using his systems of accountability to go after, which he did in Long Beach too, to go after people he didn't like that spoke up against him. And that is a very dangerous, scary environment. You know, we would all like to think that we would be Sally Field in that moment, whatever that movie. But
who's that?
Sally Field's in the
Norma Jean.
The Norma Jean, yeah.
Yeah.
Norma Jean. Norma Jean?
Yeah, right?
A different Norma Jean.
A different Norma Jean.
Standing up in a factory, and you know, it's like
Norma Ray.
I think that we have to understand. It's not about making excuses. Everybody here is part of a system, including the state's attorney's office, who relied entirely on a very poor investigative results from the police while criticizing them at the same time.
No, I'm saying this, Jesse. I'm saying, what can I hide from?
I want to beg to differ, though.
I'm talking about police officers.
I just did a story about a young man named Ivan Potts who was arrested illegally by the Baltimore 7. He spent 2 years in jail. Before that, he was arrested by Lieutenant Brian Rice, which turned out to be an illegal arrest. He spent 4 years in jail for not committing a crime. And I don't think that you can make excuses for that type. That type of behavior can't exist unless the rest of the people in the department. I totally understand about retaliation because BFL did it and other commissioners did it. It's definitely part of the system, and you're absolutely right about that. However, you know, for the people that live in the city and the people that, like Dee saying, they have to live with this, you can't expect them to accept the fact that some police officers feel uncomfortable and they're not going to talk about it and just allow criminality. You wouldn't allow us to allow criminality.
Ain't y'all heroes? I thought they was heroes. Yeah. Like, I thought they was noble. Like, now you get a chance to be like, oh my God, I don't want retaliation. I thought you was a hero. I thought you fought for the people.
Sometimes, like, explanations for things aren't excuses. They're just about understanding what's happening. And that way you can sort of figure out how to address them better. So it's not necessarily I'm excusing this or I'm excusing Judge Williams or this person or that person. It's just trying to actually understand what's happening, you know?
So I just feel like, We've restated the problem, but we have a chance to make real solutions now with the consent decree, with strengthening our whistleblower laws that govern the police department and making it a comfortable environment, changing the culture, make it a comfortable environment for officers to speak out, not stand around and watch injustice. And so that's something that we have the power to do in light of the consent decree, in light of some legislative changes that could be in the works, and also what I advocate is strengthening our civilian review board and making it a real civilian oversight board that can actually impact the policies and practices, not just of individual officers, but of the entire police department.
When homicides was high, every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West, I be getting money, but it's different on my side.
This is from the episode. You may be shocked to know that there's no official tracking system for the number of deaths that occur by the use of lethal police force in the United States. So, like, we don't even know the real number of, you know, the amount of people that are being murdered, killed, however you want to frame it, by police officers. Is there any of these things that you guys are going to be focusing on, or is there any strategy against making the people feel like we have something to look forward to? Because as of right now, I'm sure you know the climate of the city and how people feel. And then you also know what people want.
Sure. So first of all, we do in Baltimore, we do force the Baltimore Police Department to track numbers of in-custody deaths and a whole bunch of other things. And that was some legislation that we passed before I left the legislature. So there is a reporting system here. But what our board does, it was created in 1999. Those people that feel a little like it hasn't done much are correct. I felt the same way and didn't have any faith in the board before I got there. But as of recently, we are appointing 9 new people to represent the people of Baltimore throughout the city. They are all voting members, and they have the authority now to review 5 different categories of allegations of misconduct from Baltimore, not just Baltimore police, school police, sheriff's department, housing police as well. So it's not only the Baltimore Police Department, although that's the number one, you know, source of most complaints. But up until recently, a complainant had to come to the board and get file a notarized complaint. And there were just a lot of impediments and difficulties.
And you only had 90 days, right?
Right, yeah. Right. So now, as of recently, legislation created, now there's a year to file a complaint. And there's also no more notary requirement, yeah. But there are still some issues, and we're limited to those five areas of complaint. So I would just suggest that, and Stephen Janis definitely, because he's reported about it and said, you know, the board was basically not functioning. It was pretty dysfunctional in the past, but I think it's a chance to really change that. The board does have the authority. It has statutory authority to review and investigate complaints and make recommendations for disciplinary actions. And, there are still some further to go. So the consent decree calls for this civilian oversight task force that's in the process of being created now. And that task force is charged under the consent decree with reviewing the practices of the board and coming up with ways, recommendations to remove any impediments that we have. I suggest that the primary impediment is that while the board makes recommendations for disciplinary action, there's no requirement that Baltimore police or any law enforcement agency adhere to those recommendations, and that's one of the primary things.
That's a big
problem.
But
it's much bigger than just having civilians on trial boards, as some say, because, you know, it could come up in these officers in the Freddie Gray homicide that they could have trial boards, they could elect for trial boards. You can see from that case alone, that's a small, tiny, minuscule percentage of officers that we're talking about in the scheme of things that even get to the point of a trial board. So what we really need, more than civilians just on trial boards, is we need this civilian review board to be a real civilian oversight board with the authority and the resources to fully conduct interviews and make recommendations.
So if I'm like, you know, like just a resident, you know, 20-some, 30-some-year-old black person walking up and down the street, how or what do you tell them? Do you tell them that, you know, you don't have to worry about these police officers running wild and crazy because we're going to start to hold them accountable for these actions?
Yeah, so one of the issues with the board is either people don't know about the board or they don't have faith in the board. But now it's a new day, so we want to get the word out to people to please come and give us your complaint. It's still a situation where you got to give the complaint. You know, we can't just unilaterally make a decision that we're going to investigate without that initial complaint. But we do have the authority to conduct investigation and recommend discipline. And the more people that complain, the more that's going to help lift us up. Even if the outcome, and we want the outcomes to be fair, just, and correct, but even if the outcomes are not satisfactory, I think that there's strength in just more in collecting that data on the number of complaints that we have and the amount of misconduct. So right now, the complaints that we take are excessive force, false imprisonment, false arrest, abusive language and harassment. But of course, those, and Stephen, you definitely can speak to the fact that those categories are limiting. It should be beginning to end and end to beginning in terms of all of the actions of the police.
Well, when you see, like, you know, the Baltimore 7 officers one day, they ended up with a lot of complaints. But of course, before you took over, the board basically couldn't even get complaints sometimes in the police department.
Right, right.
And so people like that slip through the cracks. And, you know, I mean, even the officers who arrested Freddie Gray, you know, that's the thing when they don't, there's really no sense of accountability, no tracking, no nothing.
So
you know,
now,
fester.
So now we actually, any complaint that goes to IAD, they have to forward to us.
Right.
And so there is that part of things has improved.
That is good. That is good. And I think it is good that we have someone actually running it who cares about it now. So
We've even had a couple of successes since I've been there. Minuscule, good. but still in
we'll
terms of...
You care to share?
We made recommendations to sustain allegations of misconduct where in the past, one, the board had never in the past recommended any discipline, but that will change. But also in the past where the board had sustained allegations of misconduct and Baltimore police said, no, we don't sustain it. End of story. But now, in two instances, very small, I will be honest about, but the Baltimore police did change their recommendation once the board articulated its reasons.
That is historic.
But they're very small.
That
we just use those as a springboard.
But it's still historic.
Right.
Yeah. Because that doesn't happen. Or it didn't happen in the past.
Come on, though. It happened after the DLJ report, after the consent decree, yeah.
after Freddie
Gray.
The
change of leadership.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
Can I ask you, one of the things I find in this case that could have made a big difference is if Baltimore police and the local state's attorney's office were not in charge of this investigation and prosecution, the criminal side, laying aside the administrative side, do you think there could be a chance where Baltimore would open itself up, as many cities have, to having an outside agency at the state level or somewhere else handling those criminal investigations and decisions about prosecutions?
I think that's a heavy lift. But I think we start with the what we already have in place. And so when I talk about civilian oversight, I'd like to see there be civilian investigators, not just IAD, conducting their investigation. Mm-hmm. I think that's some place that we can start, whether it be either collaborating, like forcing inclusion of civilian investigators into the already IAD investigation, or giving it straight up to the Civilian Review Board, having them hire, you know, legitimate investigators and that are trained in it to be able to do
Jill,
it.
But, Jill, just watching, you know, when you tried to do very, very modest reforms or some visionary reforms in Annapolis, I mean, it just there's nowhere for this to go. If this was something that needed to be done through legislation, for example, because the police department is a state agency, I don't see it going anywhere.
LEOBR is still an impediment to that happening.
I think we got to
push the leverage of the consent decree and keep people involved. You know, the people that got very involved in the wake of Freddie Gray, we need that continued force and pressure, because once that pressure lessens, we already see it, that there's no real pressure that's still felt. You know, I feel like...
You slip back into the same old practices.
I feel like that's already happening. And so I know one thing. I know we are going to need the support of the people, because, again, the people are should be in control of the police and not the other way around. And we have the power to do it, but we just need the continued participation.
So I'm going to go out and make a citizen's arrest on a police officer the next time I see him or her doing something they're not supposed to be doing. I got like a little, I got a beret. I got like a jean jacket with some buttons on it.
you should do it. Why not? I mean, yeah.
What you're saying is if it goes straight from IAB to you guys, in this case, that would have been, IAB first got involved when Brandon Ross made that 911 call. So this is early in the process. That would have gone straight to you, and that could have made a big difference in this case in terms of having civilian involvement that early. That would have cut through the force investigation team, which has since been disbanded, was underqualified and, you know, helping out their friends a lot. That would have cut through supervisors and all of that, and it would have gone straight from Brandon Ross to you guys, which I think would have made a huge difference.
I think so, too. Of course, I still think there would have been a lot of resistance and a lot of impediments to our conducting investigation, as there still are some. But I do think that so now, if it happened today or tomorrow, it would be different. We would have that opportunity to get involved at a very early stage. And it really bothers me now that I've come to the office and there's cases that happened before I got there that I feel, you know, there hasn't been the ability to really bring justice or fully thoroughly.
Well, you need subpoena power. You need subpoena power for the
some of the more notorious cases in Baltimore, like, for example, the Tyrone West case is a case that I'm not certain whether there was any complaint filed with Civilian Review Board directly, but had it been just with IAD, it would have come straight to us under the new law.
That would make
system.
A big difference.
Is it too late to even go back and revisit that? Or,
well, there are people that really want it that say they want it reopened, but they have advocated to be reopened by Maryland. And what I was going to do is take it to our board, our new board, and say to the board, is there a mechanism in place where we could reconsider this? But there has to be an initial complaint to base a reconsideration on. But
that's a story.
I think that there's any
way. That's a great
story. That's a good story. I'm going
to
do that
story. Do it. We want to do it because we have to bring justice to people, because otherwise, you know, nothing is going to ever change in the city.
Mm-hmm. We have listeners around the world. You had mentioned LEOBR before. Can you say a little bit about what it is and how, what kind of barriers it presents, either one of you?
Well, no, the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights is a specific law that sort of guides what you can and cannot do to police officers. It was passed in Maryland in the 1970s, and it is one of the most protective measures, I think, across the country. And it's one of the reasons it's so difficult to discipline officers, because they have so many sort of legal hurdles. And for example, one of the big things says, you know, that an officer, well, and this part has to do with criminal law, but, you know, can wait 10 days before they have to give a statement. You know, there are all sorts of traps.
Which actually results in 5 and 6 months, yeah, sometimes a year.
Yeah, so there's just things in it that make it very difficult. And actually, one of the reasons I think they had trouble getting a civilian on the review board, this might be on the internal trial boards, was because of the LOBR. They had to.
Exactly.
So in other words, the city wanted to have one civilian on the internal trial boards, which would be end up being the final adjudication of the Freddie Gray officers. But the LOBR, they had to amend that to get it. And that's where they ran into all the pitfalls and ended up making it part of collective bargaining, which now means the union really controls
that. But how does it get amended? It's just not that complicated.
Yeah.
It gets amended because the Maryland legislature amends it. And you know, the issue is the reluctance of the legislature to take the leadership here and stop letting the FOP dictate to them what they're going to do and not do.
What invariably happens, this tells you a lot about what policing means in Baltimore versus what policing means elsewhere, is when politicians like the mayor goes down or Jill says, I want to change this, someone from Harford County or Garrett County, which are counties outside of Baltimore, say, we don't have any problems with our police. Why you guys keep messing with the police? I mean, it's literally a hostile.
Stephen, you remember this. Some years ago, like around 2009 or 10, I had a bill to add independent trial boards.
Independent trial boards, yes. Judges.
And we were practically laughed out of the committee.
No, I mean, you had a police officer testifying.
Yes, a former seasoned police officer.
Who came down to testify specifically about that. He had been one of the first people to run internal affairs, and they literally yelled at him.
They yelled. And they laughed and they treated it like a complete and total joke.
Yeah.
And they were then they were easily able to get away with that kind of behavior until the wake of Freddie Gray, when at least superficially, the leadership began to take the issue more seriously.
I know the bail lobby is huge and that the bail lobby is very powerful. So I can't believe I don't know this, but does FOP have a lobbying arm, a 501? Mm-hmm. I forget what number it is, but
there's lobby? A state FOP, there's local lodges, you know, Baltimore City's lodge number 3, and I think the county's lodge number 4, and then there's a state FOP run by Vince Canales, who, yeah, he's down there all the time. Listen, you go down to Annapolis and you will see people in uniform, which they're really not supposed to lobby in uniform. I don't think that's legal, right? But you will see when there's a police bill, halls will be lined. It'll look like some sort of Praetorian guard is sitting there, you know, just like lining the halls. So they know how to work this legislative process. And Jill's right. And I saw Jill, she had literally was by herself. There was no one there. And then there'd be 50 police officers in uniform. Lined up around the hallway.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was a legislator. You know how they say that? I'm a lawyer. I was a legislator, but I was not treated that way.
No, you were not. No. It's like a buzzsaw, the LORBI. I don't know any way you touch that. It's like the third rail in Maryland.
So I'm hoping that we get an opportunity to be able to push for some of these changes. Before you leave, let our listeners know where they can find you and keep up with you.
I'm a reporter for the Real News Network, which is therealnews.com. So if you go to therealnews.com, you can see my stories there. And I'm on Twitter as Investigative V.
Okay. Thank you. Just really quick in bullet points, everything that we can have to look forward to with the new board. Just to like summarize it for our listeners.
One, better board members, and I don't mean anything against the old ones, but more active, like activist board members that are really going to push for more authority and greater resources and to really reach out to the community. Because right now, the community needs to have faith in this board in order to utilize the board and make it grow. That's one of the things we're going to do, is a lot of outreach, get stronger board members, and then push very hard for the legislative changes that must happen. And you know, even if there aren't all legislative changes, there can be policy changes within Baltimore Police Department itself. So those are the things.
Cool. And Justine, closing remarks?
You know, a lot of this really comes down to leadership. I'm really happy to hear Jill today talking, you know, in this way. I know Baltimore Police Department could probably use better leaders at this time. I mean, I feel like we've made a strong case that many of the people in charge of Baltimore Police Department right now are involved in covering up what really happened in this case. That alone, to me, should disqualify them from taking the police department where it needs to be.
Yeah, and I think the talent is in this city. You know, I think the talent is in this city, and it just has to be recognized and given the power to do things. And I think we can move forward. So, you know, no, we're not going to end on a bad note today. We're going to end on a positive note. We're going to push towards making things better in the future. Today I had Stephen Janis, Jill P. Carter, and Justine Barron. Justine, where can we find you at?
I'm at Justine3000 on Twitter.
And Jill, where can we find you at?
Jill P. Carter on Twitter and jill.carter@baltimorecity.gov. Email, power to the people.
And fans, please continue to engage in a social media discussion. You can discuss the episode using the hashtag undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for future addenda using the hashtag UD addendum. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedPOD. And of course, I'm on all forms of social media @DWackersWorld. Thank you and have a good day.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Thanks as always to Ryan and Ernesto for continuing to support us. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum alongside super producer Methil Telhan. A big thanks to Audible for sponsoring this podcast. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more, you're going to find what you're looking for at Audible. Get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audible.com/undisclosed. To our fans, thank you for supporting our sponsors. Great sponsorship makes for great podcasts. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music. The embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @UndisclosedPod. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for the final episode of Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Until then.